You know, it takes a special breed to be a correspondent in a war zone. Some are drawn to it like a moth to the flame, the excitement, being a part of history, the ability to be a conduit for people listening in their homes. Now, the romance of the flak jacket and the microphone in hand comes with the reality that the Center for the Protection of Journalists calls being a member of the press in Iraq one of the most dangerous jobs on the planet. 124 journalists have been killed there since the war started in 03. 31 have been murdered in Iraq this year alone.
NPR's Jamie Tarabay worked 18 hours a day for on six-week rotations for the last 2 years, and she's laughing as I recount this because she can't believe she went through it, I suppose. As Baghdad bureau chief, she was one of the few female war correspondents in Iraq, reporting from the bedlam of Baghdad to the al-Qaeda stronghold of Diyala province.
Now, she's given NPR listeners incredible insight into the daily life in a war zone. Let's listen to part of a report she filed this past October about an Iraqi who feared for his life.
Hussein Ali sits quietly on a sofa, counting the worry beads gathered in his right hand. He has a mustache, which he keeps rubbing with his shirt sleeve. And even in the air-conditioned room, the sweat gathers on his brow. He's rearranged his entire life, his job, his family obligations, so that he rarely has to leave home. As much as he hates the small living room, he stays inside. Hussein begins to shake when the violent sounds of Baghdad echo through his small apartment.
What you hear right now? That's why I don't go outside. I'm scared.
There's one image in his mind he just can't shake. Several months ago, he was grocery shopping in downtown Baghdad when a bomb went off. Among the broken bodies and blood, he saw a woman's head.
Now Jamie Tarabay is starting a new adventure. One is a civilian of sorts. This past weekend, she packed up her things in Baghdad and headed via Paris and Washington, D.C., as we learned, back here to New York. She joins us now in the studio to talk about some of her favorite stories, some of the worst moments, the toughest challenges during her days in Baghdad, and what her future holds. Welcome back to the United States.
Thank you. I'm so excited. It sounds really great. I can't wait to hear it.
You were just recounting how long it took you to get home. You left Baghdad on Sunday?
Yeah. And then we flew to Jordan. And then the flight out to Paris was at 2 a.m., but it got grounded because of fog. So we were there until 8 o'clock the next evening. And then I flew to Paris, and I was in Paris for about 7 hours or so, and then I flew to D.C., and I can't remember what day it is today. Seriously, like, what day is it? I don't know.
I believe it is Thursday.
Okay, good. I'm sorry. I have no idea what day it is today. Yeah. Now I know.
It is Thursday in New York. Can we speak first about Iraq and where you just left? How was it different the day you left from the Iraq you encountered the day you got there 2 years ago?
We should, Jamie's been there for 4 years, right?
So right.
She was with us for 2 years with NPR and then 2 years with the AP. So you've got a much longer horizon even.
Yeah, I mean, when I got in there, I got in there right after the war in 03, and the difference there, it's two different countries. It was a place where the Humvees didn't have doors on them, and soldiers walked around without their body armor, and they used to line up in cafeterias and buy pizza with everybody else. It was so different back then. I felt completely different. I could stroll around. I used to go out for lunch. You know, I'd be like, I'm going out. I'd go shopping. I'd go out to restaurants. I'd go and stay over people's houses, and, you know, you'd have parties and dinner, and you could hang out. You could have a social life. And I remember getting a tip from a correspondent who was there before me, and I just wanted to know what to bring. And she said, don't bring a backpack. All the women here are carrying purses. So, I mean, it was really very social. It was a completely different atmosphere to what it's like now. Now it's, you know, you get out of the way when you see a military convoy or a Blackwater convoy or, you know, private security. You just get out of the way. People, they don't talk to each other as much. It's much more, there's such an air of distrust there now. People are really suspicious of each other, and it's changed so much. It's a completely different place now.
And would you say that there was a moment or a policy change or an incident that caused a steep change, or was it a slow change from what you described at first to what you see now?
You could see it coming. There were different signs that you could. I mean, just the ineptitude of the administration in 03, and just watching them make one mistake after another, and you know, just you're kind of staggered at just the lack of awareness. And there are obvious things that they didn't know about that you could see coming a mile away. And they just, there was no, I mean, it still exists today. I was at the US Embassy a few days ago, and I was interviewing a Marine general from who has just come out of UNBAR to do a couple of interviews with the Pentagon. And we were talking, I was talking with the Marines there, and who, by the way, miss you, Rachel, very much.
Tell them everything. I love the Marines.
and you know, they were, we were talking about how things were going, and they're very frustrated because they're in a province that is majority Sunni, and they're not getting the support that they need from a majority Shia government. And we were talking about all the problems there. And there was a, there was an embassy flak in the studio who was listening to all of this. And he kind of thrust this newsletter at me and said, you know, there is good news going on here. You should be reporting this sort of stuff. And I looked at the newsletter, and it was about scouting, like Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts in the green zone in Iraq. It was just,
it's almost surreal.
I couldn't get over it. I mean, I actually brought it back with me because I just think that is so emblematic of, you know, you live in the bubble. You have no idea what it's like outside. You have no idea how people are living, and the fact that they live under restrictions that you have no idea about because you live in this green zone, in this bubble. And I just couldn't believe the guy. I went, yeah, thank you. But I am keeping that as a souvenir.
You know, I went to hear Kimberly Dozier, who works for CBS News. I went to hear her speak. People don't remember the story. She was badly wounded, her legs crushed. People didn't know if she was going to survive or not. She said she got so many letters from people who were so impressed that she was a woman in the war zone, a woman reporter. And her point was that she's a reporter, and any reporter deserves respect who goes into a war zone. But I wondered about the reality of being a woman reporter in Iraq, specifically in these past 4 years. What specific challenges did you find, if any?
I think, you know, you got it on both sides. You got it when you worked with the military, and you got it when you dealt with Iraqis. It's very difficult for Iraqis to accept a woman doing something on her own, traveling with men who weren't related to her. And, you know, they always want to ask you, are you married? And if you're not married, then how does your father let you do this sort of thing? Particularly with me, because I speak Arabic, my parents are Lebanese, and so they felt like they could say that sort of thing to me. There's a cultural, you know, oh, you're an Arab, I can't believe you're not doing what we're doing sort of thing. So you have to kind of overcome that.
Which is more difficult, I think, than even Western reporters, because you're held to a different standard because you can speak Arabic.
I mean, it doesn't matter what you do, and it doesn't matter how you dress sometimes. You know, I was going through a checkpoint once with Abdullah, one of our staff, and the Iraqi was talking to him, and I was all wrapped up. You know, I had a headscarf on. I was wearing a long kind of coat thing. And, you know, Abdullah came away just kind of chuckling to himself. And I said, what was so funny? And he said, oh, the guy was asking if you were wearing the headscarf out of security reasons or out of religious reasons. He thought I was local. And I said, well, why would he ask me something like that? He said, well, because he wants to hit on you. You know, I mean, it doesn't matter. There's no such thing as being covert if you're a woman, especially if you are in a war zone. You know, if you're in the military, you're working with the military, with the soldiers, they're like, oh, my God, you're a female, and you're surrounded by infantrymen. So, I mean, when the guys that I embed with, they say, you know, Jamie, there's no like ranking system from 1 to 10 for women. It's like it's a binary world. You're a 1 or a 0. You know, so I mean, they're just very gratified to have women around them, sort of thing. So that can help you, and that can also work against you.
I do want to get to a little more of your reporting. Mm-hmm. One of the last stories you did before you were leaving was about a 13-year-old girl. Can you tell us a little bit about her story, and then we'll throw you a clip of it?
She literally was a girl who was on the brink of becoming lost. You just knew that she was doing things that was going to lead her down this path of just despair. You could see that she was becoming very curious about interacting with men and the flirting and the dressing, the way that she was dressed. She was wearing, you know, this tight jeans, this tight t-shirt, you know, and she was very lax about making sure her headscarf was on. And everybody who knew her was saying, this is a girl who's on her way to becoming a prostitute. And, you know, there were moments when she would deny it, but then there were moments when she knew too much about it to be able to, like, you know, feign innocence. So you just knew she was she was just about to fall. You just kind of could see it coming, you know. It was really quite depressing.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of Jamie Tarabay's report.
They warned her. They said, "Behave yourself, or else we'll shave your head and take you to mosque and punish you by religious law."
But whatever the threat, it's not enough to convince Rahat to avoid trouble. Their neighbors, a friendly husband and wife, say they try to help. The wife wants to buy Rahat more conservative clothes and appeals to the young girl to follow her elder sister's more chaste example. But Rahat is also like any teenage girl growing up, shy and at the same time curious.
I ask my friends what it is in me that men find so attractive. They tell me they just want to have fun.
She says she tries not to pay attention to the men, but it's hard to look away.
I was lucky enough to be able to be in Baghdad this summer when Jamie was there. And I remembered one particular story that you reported about this group of folk musicians in Baghdad. And this was a special story. I actually was gone. I was on an embed when this really neat concert happened. But I wanted Jamie to explain kind of the context of this, and then we'll throw it at the tape.
The group, they do a traditional, it's called the Baghdadi Square, and it's called the square because the lyrics are written in a, you know, kind of 4x4 sort of, I don't know how they do it, but it's a very traditional way of singing, and this troupe, they dress in traditional costumes, and they you know, when they used to work publicly, they could dress in their costumes and go through the street singing and, you know, playing their instruments, and people would just kind of come with them and follow them to where they had to go. Mm-hmm. But they can't do that anymore. You know, they hide their instruments. They don't wear their costumes anymore. You know, when they came to our office, you know, one of them had his drum in a flour sack, and another one had his tambourine in the gym bag, or, you know, but our staff was so happy when these guys came and played, and they were all singing and clapping, and it was just, you could see what it was that made them so much fun. And it's just
once
something
upon
that,
a time.
Yeah, it's just, it was, you know, another thing that, you know, it was bittersweet to be able to watch it and, you know.
Let's listen to a little bit of it.
A graduate of Baghdad's Music Institute, Abedi's been playing the tabla for 27 years. He wishes the troupe didn't have to perform secretly, leaving its costumes at home.
I really feel frustrated that we cannot perform as we used to. Music is the food of the spirit, and the artist is above all the politics. I really feel pain that the situation has come to this.
This was special in large part, Jamie, because life is so tough there. You just don't get to see musicians. I mean, when this happened, they performed on the front lawn of the NPR house,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, it was really amazing. One of our drivers was so moved by it, he actually had to get out and go and sit in the kitchen, and he cried. It was just really, you could just, it's gone. It's something that you just can't do anymore.
Well, Jamie, you're in New York for a very lovely reason. And I don't know you that well. I've listened to you on NPR forever, but so I feel like I can ask you about this. You're getting hitched.
I am. I am in like 3 weeks and a bit.
And your biggest decision, come on, tell them, is now?
Oh, God. The Manolos or the Jimmy Choo's.
Exactly.
Is that just the weirdest thing
in your mind? NPR's Iraq correspondent making decisions about designer shoes.
I know that 2 weeks ago you were in Baghdad, and now you can't decide which heels to wear on your wedding day.
It's Jimmy Choo.
You have to see them. They're pretty sassy.
I'm saying. I've done some inspection in this area, and I'm counseling Jimmy.
But Jamie loves just dressing up when you come home, right?
I do. I do. It's part of what I like to do. And, you know, just you feel like a girl again. I had the same wardrobe for, you know, however many years that I was there. And literally, I was one of those people who didn't have to pack a bag to go to Baghdad because all my stuff was there already.
Well, Jamie Tarabay, we wish you the greatest luck and have a fantastic wedding. You'll look beautiful, I'm sure.
Thank you.
Thank you for all your work that you've done. As an NPR listener, I'm new to as an employee, but as a listener, thank you for all the work that you've done.
Thank
over
you.
The past
it's
few
my
years.
Pleasure.
Mazel tov.
Thanks.
Thanks for joining us for this hour with the Bryant Park Project. We're always available online at npr.org/Bryant Park. I'm Allison Stewart.
I'm Bill Wolf. This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.